Again, you are listening to KDVS Davis 90.3 FM. I'm Richard Estes. This is Speaking in Tongues, as I said. Please take note that the following views presented in this program do not reflect the views of KDVS. KDVS sponsors the University of California. And as I mentioned, my guest for the first half hour or so today is Bradley Allen. He's an independent journalist and activist. He's done a number of pretty striking things, and so it's a good opportunity to have him on the air today to talk about those. I had originally intended to have him on air to talk about the situation in Salinas, and fortunately he directed me to someone else that I could speak with on that subject, and we had an excellent interview with Elliot on that, and we may get around to speaking with Bradley about that as well today. But there's a number of other things I want to ask him about as well based upon his broad experience. Bradley, welcome to Speaking in Tongues.
Thank you, Richard. Thank you for having me.
I guess to start, you've been an independent reporter and photographer for, I guess, at least 10 years now, if not longer. What motivated you to do it?
Well, once upon a time, a very long time ago, like talking the late 90s, early 2000s, there was an active movement to create media that was as independent as possible from all financial interests. So as a way to fight for environmental and social justice, I became involved in creating radical and independent media.
And so that was the was that part of the indie media effort around the turn of the decade in the early 2000s?
That's correct. There was a local chapter of the Santa Cruz Independent Media Center, and I became active with that, which actually had meetings that I'd participate in, and it was a pretty cool on the ground organization for a bit of time. By 2006, the Santa Cruz Independent Media Center integrated with the San Francisco Bay Area Independent Media Center, which is indiebay.org, which also has indiebay.org/Central Valley, which includes Davis and Sacramento, Fresno, for example. And so we're part of that whole larger Northern California collective now here in Santa Cruz and the Monterey Bay.
And what were the sorts of stories that you and others in the collective emphasized during that period?
Oh, well, homelessness has always been a large issue in Santa Cruz and downtown Santa Cruz. So there's always been a lot of coverage of that on Santa Cruz Indie Media, different issues of protest, labor, things at the University of California at Santa Cruz, diversity, race, all kinds of issues, a range of social justice issues, environmental issues. Bicycle riding.
It seems that when I've come across stories about Santa Cruz at the Indie Bay site, indiebay.org, there do seem to be quite a number of stories about homelessness, and this goes back years and years. Why is the issue of homelessness, or maybe issue is not the right word to use, but why is homelessness such a polarizing issue in Santa Cruz?
Well, the main economic stretch of downtown Santa Cruz and cultural area is Pacific Avenue. And so that's where a lot of the tension is around, is Pacific Avenue and the visibility of homelessness. And, a lot of people feel that Santa Cruz is a city that provides a lot of resources for people that are experiencing homelessness, and that's definitely true to a certain extent, I would say, not speaking from personal experience. And, it's Santa Cruz is a place where people are attracted to come for various reasons, but there's just a lot of resentment, too, about that homelessness and there's always this feeling of outsiders, and I think this is probably true in a lot of towns where there's a mentality of, these people aren't from here, they're outsiders, so why are they coming here? Why don't they just stay wherever they came from? go back to where you came from. That's the sentiment among a lot of the local community of Santa Cruz, I would say, unfortunately.
Well, it's interesting to me because although I may be soft, I may be presenting this a little too softly, I live in Sacramento, and Sacramento has historically always had a substantial homeless population for reasons that go back to its development as a city and the economic history of the city as a center of seasonal labor in the Central Valley. And while, of course, there certainly is a sharp edge to how people relate to homelessness in Sacramento, I don't perceive that it has the degree of hostility that it does in Santa Cruz. You know, I mean, it's not uncommon to encounter homeless people in Sacramento, particularly in the downtown and in the central city and surrounding neighborhoods. And while people aren't necessarily enthusiastic about it, I don't perceive the same degree of hostility that I perceive in Santa Cruz. So it seems there's something about Santa Cruz perhaps being a coastal community or having gone through a gentrification process in the last 30 or 40 years that seems to have intensified the situation there. Is that possible?
Yeah, I don't know why. But problems do seem to be blamed on that community, the population of people that are experiencing homelessness. From a lot of drugs has to be brought into the picture, anti-gang mentality, anti-Latino culture, like kind of mixing in a lot of these issues. Needles have become a big point of contention within Santa Cruz, the discovery of used hypodermic needles. And so providing resources, instead of providing resources for people or supporting the resources that exist, community members on the city cracked down and closed down a needle exchange program that had been existing for at least 20 years, I believe, and made it more restrictive and put those services more farther away from the downtown and at the county health services and restricted the hours. And then you have the neighbors in that area that are then upset about those services being located in their neighborhood. And then a lot of issues, you know, with the people living in the parks and in the mountains. And so, I don't know, I guess you have environmentalists who are, you know, so-called into the environment, but don't like to see people, you know, and blame people for the things that they're going through. And I'm sure that there's some people that are in Santa Cruz and, you know, may not represent everybody, but it's easy to, there's just such a range of people that are going through so many different things, but it's easy to like paint a picture in your head based on the actions of one or two people. So there's, you know, just been polarizing events. There was a senseless murder that happened a few years ago by somebody who had health problems, mental health problems, and was a transient. And so that, you know, really was something that tipped off the community to get into this, like, action where you have, you know, the so-called best activist group is more of a kind of conservative, you know, leaning group, I would say, in the community. Even though they wouldn't picture themselves that way, they work with the police and they do community cleanups to clean up the environment and pick up needles and do things like that, you know, and advocate for people that have been killed through violence. But there's a lot of tones of anti-homelessness and and just pro-police sentiments within this organization. So how they act, you know, has come under a lot of question over the years, too. But, yeah.
You're listening?
Oh. But initially.
Yeah, you're listening to KDVS Davis 90.3 FM, KDVS Davis 90.3 FM. I'm Richard Estes. This is Speaking in Tongues. I'm speaking with independent reporter and photographer Bradley Allen. If you want to know more about him and his work, you can go to bradleyallen.net, and I recommend that you do so. Riverside Wesleyan Church reminds women to obtain screening mammograms at recommended intervals. Contact the hospital or clinic of your choice today. Don't delay. The earliest diagnosis is your best chance for successful treatment. This message is courtesy of Riverside Wesleyan Church in Sacramento. Information about their Sunday worship service is available at rwcsac.org, rwcsac.org. Riverside Wesleyan Church is on the air because they care about the health of the women in our community. Bradley, let me sort of transition to another subject here.
Could I say something else before you do?
Yes, please do.
Along those lines, we're talking about Santa Cruz Independent Media Center and IndieBay.org, which we call the Bay Area Independent Media Center. And if you go to IndieBay.org/Central Valley, you'll see a feature article called What It Is Like to Be Homeless in Downtown Fresno. And Mike Rhodes, for example, has done some remarkable coverage over the years of interviewing people, doing photo documentation, as well as video and audio recordings. And so it helps to get a richer sense of understanding of not only what's happening in Santa Cruz, but what's happening in Fresno, and to, you know, kind of compare and contrast, you know, how things are, you know, repressive in both areas. But I would definitely say, without even going to Fresno myself, just from reading about it over the years, things are very repressive for the people that are experiencing homelessness in Fresno, in such a hot place without enough resources for people. People are getting their little shanty houses that they build in small communities bulldozed, you know, over and over again, and it's just tragic. So it's definitely not just in Santa Cruz.
Well, I appreciate you bringing that up, because it motivates me to look into whether or not Mike Rhodes might be a good guest on this program in the future. So I appreciate you mentioning that.
You're welcome.
Now, back in 2005, you went to New Orleans immediately after Hurricane Katrina. And people may think this is kind of an old subject, but I really don't believe that it is. I'm a little bit alarmed, actually, at how Hurricane Katrina and the events associated with it seem to have been submerged in the memory of so many people. And so I really want the opportunity to ask you about some of your experiences there, since it was less than 10 years ago. What did you encounter in New Orleans when you went there?
Well, I first came into Houston, and then drove into New Orleans. When I first came into New Orleans, it was both inspiring, because I immediately got, connected with the collective that later that became the Common Ground Collective as I was there, with Malik Rahim and Scott Crowe, for example. And so that was really inspiring to be a part of that effort, and it was much larger than those two names that I mentioned. But it involved a health clinic, it involved a radio station, which I helped to establish, which I helped deliver the gear for from Houston to New Orleans. And this grassroots effort was just absolutely amazing. But it was in contrast to the most devastating situation that I've ever experienced in my life. It was just tragic. You know, I was in New Orleans in the Algiers neighborhood, which was not flooded. It's a little bit higher ground, and just across like the bridge from downtown New Orleans where the areas were flooded. But people hadn't received any services. You know, I was there before the FEMA truck came around to provide any food to people. So I mean, people, it was really, there were still bodies that hadn't been recovered on the streets and, you know, in the situation, or at least, you know, my friend Jacob had documented that. And there just wasn't really news getting out of what happened. And as I was there, internet got set up by some of the more techie people. As, like, phone connection got set up, we were immediately able to get online and create, like, an independent media center right there in the Algiers neighborhood as the Common Ground Collective was forming. But, I mean, trees were tipped over, cars were on their side. People didn't have resources, so the Common Ground Collective, you know, just put together supplies that were donated from all across the country. You know, people sending canned goods and cleaning supplies, food, drinks, water. And it was just a real, while FEMA was basically scratching their head, not doing anything to help people, certainly not doing enough. That's what was happening.
My impression from some of the people I interviewed afterwards on this program, actually, was that FEMA seemed to be more concerned about maintaining social order or perceived threats, or addressing perceived threats to social order, than they were about actually providing assistance to the populace. Was that your impression as well?
Yes. It was very militarized. They had martial law in effect, which I experienced, actually. And it was quite scary. You weren't allowed to walk around at night, you know, and there's nothing more stressful than just this situation. And so, of course, you want to take a walk, you know, around the neighborhood. And it's like my friend and I were detained by Homeland Security just for taking a walk at night. We're lucky, you know, that it didn't get worse than what happened, basically.
Yeah, I think there have been a number of stories. Maybe Scott Crowe has related some of them in terms of being confronted by police and Homeland Security when they were actually trying to deliver water and food to people.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I'm just looking at a picture right now of bicycles loaded on a truck, on a trailer that were delivered from Austin and were delivered through the Common Ground Collective throughout the Algiers neighborhood. Kids on bicycles, and that's the type of grassroots response that was just so, you know, effective and inspiring and appreciated by community members there throughout, you know, the neighborhoods of New Orleans. And I was just there for, you know, a short window of time, but I know that things continued to get established into other neighborhoods. But I was also there as things transitioned from a very grassroots response to it, like a nonprofit, you know, very like more high profile kind of professionalized health clinic. And that was a kind of a interesting transition to see and witness, and not always a comfortable one.
What did you observe in relation to that transition?
Well, people kind of coming in and changing the dynamics of things without, from a more top-down approach, while things had been done in a more consensus-based fashion. And so, you know, some people kind of just moved on, and other people probably stayed with it and helped in that transition, and some people were probably welcomed and maybe some people weren't. But for example, in the health clinic, the brochures went from more anarchist brochures about that kind of response to health to a more professional, you know, more professional brochures and things like that. Like, let's not have those brochures out anymore. And even though it was those people with those ideologies that did respond first and set things up the way that way that things were, you know, set up with herbs and medicines and things like that. So I'm not saying that it's wrong. I'm just saying that it was a tension and a transition, it seems like.
You're listening to KDVS 90.3 FM in Davis, KDVS Davis 90.3 FM. I'm Richard Estes. This is Speaking in Tongues. I'm speaking with independent reporter and photographer Bradley Allen. Again, if you want to learn more about him, please visit his website at bradleyallen.net, where you will find an impressive array of articles and photographs. And you can also go to indiebay.org as well for additional information on some of the subjects we've been talking about today. One of the things I noticed on your website was that you visited the Dome City in Houston.
Yes.
Perhaps it might be good for you to describe exactly what the Dome City was and then relate your experiences there.
I first came into Houston for about 4 days, then went to New Orleans for about 4 days, and then back to Houston for 4 days. And so things were just very sad at the domes. It was very difficult. You know, I was there on September 9th through September 11th, and thousands of Katrina survivors arrived in Houston and spent weeks in the Astrodome and other buildings, which became known as Dome City. And people were on cots under lights. And I came into Houston to try and help establish a radio station, and people were all ready to set up a radio station to help people, you know, cope and survive and get information. And the FCC and FEMA worked to block those efforts and kept coming up with excuse after excuse to prevent people from setting up a radio station. And that's why I eventually took that equipment to New Orleans. It wasn't my equipment, but, you know, it came from Austin, I believe, and it was facilitated by the Prometheus Radio Project out of Philadelphia. But, you know, I helped, and as an experienced radio journalist, and the people that I, and my friend that I was with, was a radio journalist and a video journalist. And so we just helped to take that equipment. But, they just weren't even allowed. They kept being denied service after service at the Astrodome, and people were treated in a really unfriendly way. Why you would have people basically across the street going to an Astro game as if everything was okay, you know, because they had other stadiums across the street. There was the Reliant Center in Houston, and then there was like the George Brown Center. But I know one of the times I was there, I could see, you know, just people going across the street while other people were just being denied services. And the things that you take for granted, or that I would say a lot of people listening to this take for granted, is the ability to use a credit card. I was able to use a credit card in New Orleans to rent the car, or maybe it was Houston. I think it was New Orleans. But, you know, there was somebody else who survived the Hurricane Katrina and had his wallet washed away, and he wasn't able to rent a car. And it's like, that didn't feel very right. That didn't feel very good. And he's like, no, I don't have a credit card. But, like, I don't know if he ever had a credit card. But it's like he wasn't being helped out in any way, him and his family. Where I was able just to be like, yeah, I got a credit card. Oh, okay, here you go. Here's your car. Go ahead. So
how did people – I have a couple of questions about Dome City to the extent that you know the answers to them. How did people end up in the Dome City, and then how did they get out of it?
Well, people fled on their own and arrived in Houston. I'm not sure what kind of public transportation was provided to get out of New Orleans, but not enough. For example, I'm looking at photos of buses that were just left to flood in New Orleans, photos that I took. And I don't know why those buses were not used at all, but they just have watermarks on a whole lot of, on a lot of city buses. I mean, like a parking lot of city buses. But as far as how people left the domes, I think they were kicked out, and they were kicked out on buses, and they were shipped to places without any choice of where they were taken to. I saw people leaving in buses where they didn't know where they were going, and they were being taken to places like Arkansas. I'm looking at my pictures now. Hundreds of people who were unable to secure housing while at Reliant Arena loaded in a bus is headed to Ellington Field, which I believe is Ellington Field in Houston, where they would be flown to Fort Chaffee, an abandoned Air Force base in rural Arkansas. So people were dispersed all across the country. I knew as far as Seattle, for example.
Yeah, a lot of people, I mean, they never really had the opportunity to return, did they?
No, I don't think so. Like, people were just waiting and hoping. Hundreds of people waited outside hoping for some form of housing. But children just didn't know when they would be able to go back to school. Katrina survivor from New Orleans was trying to find his son. Another man in a motor scooter was a poet trying to find his mom in Atlanta. You know, people were just trying to get connected with family members. For example, in the domes, there was just a whole collage of little post-it notes and pieces of paper with pictures and phone numbers of people just looking for their loved ones. You know, like, have you seen this person?
I remember even reading stories years later. This would have been around 2007, 2008. About how people were shipped out to housing in rural areas of states like Mississippi and Alabama, and they ended up being housed in these places that had known, for lack of a better word, toxicity issues. I mean, they were exposed to types of substances and home construction materials that today, you know, are illegal. You can't even use them in construction. So it's really...
Yeah.
It's pretty frightening what ended up happening to many of these people, and I think it's a story that probably remains to be told more fully.
Mm-hmm. It's true.
Bradley, can I ask you a favor? We're coming up on the half hour.
Sure.
If you have another 10 or 15 minutes to provide me, I'd really like to talk further with you.
Sure.
If you have some time constraints, just let me know, and I'll graciously let you off air. In the meantime, I need to take a little bit of a transition here to some important half hour announcements. So I'll be right back with you on the other side of the break. Was that fine for you?
Yeah, that works. Thanks, Richard.
Okay.
Thank you, everybody.
Thank you very much. You're listening to KDVS Davis. KDVS Davis 90.3 FM. This is Speaking in Tongues. Please pay careful attention to the following.
Hi, I'm Richard Karn. If you're like me, your holiday shopping list this year probably includes cordless electronics. Well, here's how to make everyone happy and do something good for the environment. Shop for the seal. Make sure the rechargeable battery inside that new cell phone, cordless power tool, or laptop computer has the RBRC recycling seal. To learn more, call me at 1-800-8-BATTERY. Or visit us on the web at www.rbrc.org.
When I have an asthma attack, I feel scared. kind of like an elephant is on my chest.
I feel like I'm choking.
Sometimes my parents have to take me to the hospital.
You know how to react to their asthma attacks. Here's how to prevent them. Call 1-866-NO-ATTACKS. Visit www.noattacks.org or call your doctor. Because even one attack is one too many.
I feel like a fish with no water.
Brought to you by the EPA and the Ad Council.
Sacramento Food Not Bombs provides free vegetarian meals to people in need every Sunday at 1:30 p.m. in Cesar Chavez Park, located at 10th and I Streets in downtown Sacramento. To find out how you can help by volunteering or donating goods, please email sactofoodnotbombs@yahoo.com for more information. You're listening to KDVS Davis 90.3 FM. I'm Richard Estes. This is Speaking in Tongues, and I am talking with Bradley Allen, an independent reporter and photographer. You can learn more about him and gain access to a great deal of his both written and photographic work at bradleyallen.net. Bradley, you were involved in something that was described as the Santa Cruz 11. What were you and the other participants in the Santa Cruz 11 doing?
There was definitely a lot more than 11 participants. There was hundreds of people that came out to a demonstration on November 30th, 2011 in downtown Santa Cruz. It was in front of the courthouse in Santa Cruz. And it was announced as a demonstration against, you know, as part of, in solidarity with Occupy Santa Cruz and a protest, you know, to support like a foreclosed home. And so a lot of people showed up to this demonstration, and I showed up to cover it for Indie Bay, as I'd been doing other stories documenting Occupy Santa Cruz. And so people showed up to this march, and there had been other demonstrations in Santa Cruz that, as part of Occupy Santa Cruz, where people protested in front of and marched in front of, like, Bank of America and Wells Fargo. So that was my assumption, was that this was going to be a march where people marched around and protested for 5 minutes or so in front of, you know, Bank of America, and 5 minutes in front of Chase, and 5 minutes in front of Wells Fargo, and, you know, march down Pacific Avenue, you know, hand out flyers, things like that. But it was more of a surprise to the large majority of the people there when a large empty building, that even though it's a giant empty building and it had been empty and vacant for 3 years, it's not the only big empty building in Santa Cruz or in most of our communities. There's probably big empty buildings. And so I know myself, I didn't even really pay much attention to it. Didn't even really notice it very much. Didn't think much of it. It's across the street from the Wells Fargo Bank, and it used to be a different branch. But like I said, to people's surprise, the doors were opened to this bank by some of the demonstrators that were like at the front of the march, and people said, "Hey, come on in." And so a large number of people did go through those doors into the bank or into that empty building, what was a former bank. And I'm one of the people that went inside. I was there taking pictures, documenting what was happening, and later that night published my photos and wrote an article about it. So different people went in with different knowledge and different intentions, but this what became a building occupation lasted for about 3.5 days. So it was, you know, perhaps, you know, some people had plans in advance because, you know, people brought in some furniture and had some signs and passed out some flyers, but it was never announced as a building occupation. It was announced as a march and a demonstration. So Does that answer your question?
Yes, it does. I find your description interesting because I interviewed Hannah Dobbs about a year, year and a half ago, who wrote a book. I'm trying to remember the title of it now. Not One More Inch or anyway, it's a book about squatting and various other rights that people have in terms of accessing housing and defending themselves. Some of it involves squatting. Some of it involves getting out of your loan. Some of it involves a variety of different aspects of how to deal with the housing crisis, which was particularly acute at that time. So I find your description interesting because one of the things she mentions in her the portions of the book that address basically taking over empty homes, empty residential buildings, is that there's different approaches. One approach is to do it in a very highly visible manner in which it's announced ahead of time and it's given a very strong ideological orientation. The other, which appears to be much more common and has been utilized for probably at least two decades now, has been to be very surreptitious about it and sort of research properties very carefully, look for ones that have particularly tangled legal histories, and then take those properties very quietly and move into them and start living in them. It sounds like the one you're describing is more like the former as opposed to the latter. But even in your case, it wasn't announced in advance.
Right, that's accurate.
3.5 days, people stated. Were people eventually removed by the police?
No, there was police that were there the first day, and there was kind of a standoff with the police. People were outside the building. You know, people who didn't enter the building there was a lot of people outside the building that provided ideological support to people inside or just standing witness, or some people formed a line to kind of put themselves between the occupation and the police. There was a couple different standoffs, one of which I was at, like the more immediate one, but I wasn't at the one that took place later in the evening, but I've seen video of it. And at that one in the evening, the police tried to enter, but were prevented from entering by people on the inside, basically holding the doors closed, and there was barricaded doors with furniture. And so the police weren't able to enter the building, unlike a house where the police could come in and say, okay, we're going to go ahead and just break this window and just come on in. This is a bank building, so it wasn't so easy to come on into the building. So there was, after the first day, the police, you know, they didn't try and force their way in after the first day. But they came back and they posted signs like no trespassing, because they didn't have any no trespassing signs that were posted on this building. So, you know, a lot of people didn't have any idea what this building was. I mean, there was people, you know, calling their friends, word spreading far and wide, and people are coming down to this building and like having a party into the night. On various nights of this occupation. So some people, you know, didn't even know that they're in some kind of, you know, building squat or occupation or anything like that. There was all kinds of people that were in the space, and there wasn't any like big, you know, there wasn't any fence around the building. There wasn't no trespassing signs. So technically people weren't trespassing because they didn't break and enter and they didn't refuse to leave. They were just invited into a building and they hung out there, and they, you know, nobody goes out to a party and says, you know, or a restaurant or anywhere and says, can I see the ownership permits for this space? No, you just enjoy your time in the building. I mean, some things are obviously more established than others, and there's more common sense, but my point is that not everybody knows at all times what they may or may not be participating or not in. So
after
the demonstration, the police were put fences around the building, boarded up the building, put up no trespassing signs. But it was just, Wells Fargo had just swallowed this other bank across the street and didn't really bother to board it up or anything like that. So now you see more signs around Santa Cruz that are more explicit and say no trespassing.
Well, one of the interesting dynamics in relation to the police, which wasn't so prominent here, but when you have these situations where you no longer have clear title of the property because of people purchasing it and then getting caught up in all types of legal snafus with banks, lenders of various kinds, service providers, is that the police don't really have anyone they can go to ask as to whether the people should be there.
Right. That was one of the things that was taking place, is the police, it wasn't clear who owned the building, and it took a while for the person responsible from Wells Fargo to come and talk to the police and sign the papers and order make an order for people to leave, basically.
Yeah, the police are very, this is one of the areas where the police actually tend to be a little bit careful because they have significant liability issues. If they go and remove somebody from a property and get caught up in a very contentious arrestee situation when it turns out that the owner never asked them to remove the person. So it's a little bit of a convoluted situation in a lot of these instances.
Well, what the police chose to do is they did surveillance like they've been doing over the whole march, and they did video and photos, and they made a wish list of their people who they didn't like, and then people that, so of a list of like 13, they made a list of like, well, they made a couple different lists. First they said they made a list of like 30 people, then they said they made, but it ended up being 11 people that were charged. But of those 11 people, about half of them were pretty high-profile activists that had been a thorn in the side of the political establishment for various ways and reasons for a long time. And that's how I got onto that list, as well as Robert Norris, who's been covering homeless issues for a really long time and other civil rights issues, and Becky Johnson and, Grant Wilson, who's done a lot of community organizing. Alex is another photographer with Indie Bay that had been doing coverage that, may have exposed different political establishment in unfavorable light. So it was a very, very political list that they made. They didn't charge the Sentinel, the Santa Cruz Sentinel, the mainstream corporate newspaper. They didn't charge that photographer for coming into the building and publishing photos from inside. They didn't even charge the Santa Cruz Patch, photographers for publishing stories from inside the building. So it was, I feel that it was very political in the list that they chose. They documented other people entering the building, but chose not to charge them. So it seemed very, very political in nature. How did they determine a list, and just to charge those 11 people with crimes that they weren't even guilty of. And the charges against me were absolutely ridiculous. I was charged with felony conspiracy and to commit vandalism, and I was charged with felony vandalism, and I was charged with misdemeanor, trespass, breaking an entry, misdemeanor, trespass, refusing to leave, and none of those crimes was I guilty of. And the argument on behalf of the DA's argument was that I took photographs of this demonstration and I published them on my website and on indiebay.org, and that people saw those photographs and were encouraged to come to this building, and they decided to vandalize the building, and that even though I didn't conspire with anybody, and even though I didn't vandalize anything, that just by publishing photos in a new, you know, news photographs, that I should be held responsible for other people's vandalism.
So what,
basically arguing that the difference between me and the Santa Cruz Sentinel is that I'm an activist and that I ideologically, you know, am more aligned with the demonstration.
So what was the outcome of your case?
Well, the charges against me were eventually dismissed, thanks largely to intervention on behalf of, you know, national organizations such as the Reporters Committee for Freedom of the Press, the Northern California ACLU, Society for the Protection of Journalists, and another organization that I'm leaving out, you know, all came out in support of not me, they weren't coming out to support Bradley Allen, they weren't coming out to say, oh, you know, this guy's done some great coverage, you should see what he did, you know, in New Orleans. It wasn't about that at all. They came out only in response to the charges against me and how absurd they were and, you know, what a violation they were of press freedom, arguing what I just described as that I should be charged with conspiracy and vandalism just because my photographs were viewed by people who may or may not have come and vandalized, you know, spray painted on some walls inside a building.
So
that's what the organizations came out in defense of.
So Bradley, were there any convictions in these convictions or plea deals in these cases at all?
So far, there all 11 people had to have their own attorneys, and so the cases were kind of split up in different ways for different. For various reasons, and different people kind of waiving time or not waiving time. For example, I did not waive the time for a speedy trial. I demanded the speedy trial, whereas other people waived their time. And so far, 7 people have had their charges completely dismissed, all charges dismissed. Not dropped, which I like to clarify. Dropped implies that the DA, you know, decided to drop the charges, and that's not what happened.
No, dismissed is when the court does it.
Right. So the charges against 7 people were dismissed, but there's 4 people that are still facing, of the original 4 charges, 2 felonies and 2 misdemeanors. I believe they have 1 felony and 2 misdemeanors, and their case is being delayed for various reasons of scheduling and different motions. So, you know, all these years later, they're still kind of being dragged through this basically presumed guilty process where you're not allowed to, you know, technically leave the state of California. You're, you know, you're under all these conditions that are just pretty terrible to be going through. It was really, really a lot to be going through for the 3 months or so that I was going through it, you know, from when the charges were filed, basically, till the time they were dismissed. But to this day, I still feel like I'm going through it as there's other people that, you know, were charged that are still dealing with it. So in various ways, it's going to be with me forever, you know.
Bradley, let me ask you one last question before I let you go here, because you've
sure.
been so generous with your time today. You've been covering events in Salinas since the 3 police shootings there. In the last few weeks, what has happened there? I talked with Elliot in relation to the initial protests that erupted and conflict between some protesters and what he described as efforts to sort of contain the protest within socially accepted bounds. What's been transpiring since then?
Well, there's a lawsuit that's being, well, that's probably, that may or may not be filed. Attorney John Burris, based out of Oakland, is representing the family of Carlos Mejia. Carlos Mejia was the person who was most recently killed by Salinas police officers, as far as we know, in Salinas. His execution was captured on video by a 19-year-old woman and posted to YouTube. And before that video was posted, the police, you know, crafted their story, and the chief of police refined it, and they came out saying that Carlos Mejia was carrying these shears, and that he threatened the officers, and that he actually came at the officers. But then this video comes out showing that he wasn't threatening the officers. He certainly wasn't lunging at them like the police chief had said before the video came out. It shows that he was merely kind of walking away from the officers in a kind of confused, probably panicked stage as two police officers surround him and just gun him down. And so so that's what happened. And so hopefully, I guess what John Burris said at a press conference was that if they don't, settle with the family and admit to wrongdoing, then they'll be filing a civil rights lawsuit. And so I don't think that that's been filed yet, but, you know, the way the community of Salinas is responding is, bringing in outside, mediators to cool things off, basically to calm everyone down. That's the big buzzword, is just calm down. Don't be so angry. You know, just wait. Don't protest. Don't be mad. You know, just come together. You know, everybody's, kind of paraphrasing here, more or less, but they're saying, everybody's hurt. Even the police officers, the police officers don't like shooting people, so they're hurting too, as they're on their paid vacation and then already back on the job. And it's just complete, ludicrousy. And so you have organizations, nonprofit organizations and unions in the community and politicians that are working to silence the anti-police sentiments within the community of Salinas. And when there was a demonstration on May 25th, which was just 5 days after the killing of Carlos Mejia, these organizers were especially hostile, or so-called organizers. I call them co-opters because there wasn't an already established organization, and this is a very important point, is there wasn't an already established organization in the community working against police violence and police brutality. So when people came together to express their outrage, it was so easy for these nonprofit organizations and politicians to just come and co-opt that community organizing and outrage and turn their dignified rage into a protest that was completely pacified. And, what was announced as a march against police brutality and attracted organizations from, as far north as Santa Rosa and, Sacramento, and as far south as Orange County and cities all in between, people coming out in solidarity with Salinas and to express their outrage and to, share what's happening in their communities. And they were met by people that were part of these established organizations like the UFW and LULAC that have historically, been hostile to community movements and continued to show that, to be that way at that demonstration on that day. And so people who brought their own signs to the demonstration were told, no, you can't carry your own signs. You can only use the signs that we made. And so, again, the March Against Police Brutality was turned into the March for Peace and Respect and Dignity, which nobody would disagree with the need for, respect and dignity. But, that wasn't the point of the demonstration. And to silence people's anti-police sentiments is just not right. And it wasn't just silencing. The organizers will try and tell you that, oh, we were just silencing people from other communities, as if that's acceptable. But the truth is that the people who came out of their homes from East Salinas were carrying signs with their own messages, handwritten in Spanish, which, translated into English are, we don't want killer police in our communities. No justice, no peace, with no respect without justice, things that weren't even that radical. They were obvious. Of course you don't want killer police in your community. Of course, no justice, no peace. Of course, without justice, there's no respect. But, even signs like that were too anti-police at a demonstration that was supposedly against police brutality.
It's very unfortunate because it's an old pattern. It's an old pattern in terms of kind of relying upon this kind of social strata of people that within a community that have been integrated into the larger powers, more predominantly white and affluent power structure, and then using them to kind of keep everyone else within acceptable boundaries. So it seems
it's not white, but
I'm talking about the more general sense nationally. But
yeah.
In Salinas is a little different. But I mean, you integrate these people into the power structure, and then pacifying people becomes one of their major priorities.
And so you contrast that with the community most similar to Salinas is the community of Oxnard, a little bit farther south in Southern California. It's a town that has, predominantly strawberries and a large, goes back to the Bracero days, way before that. And in this community, they have an organization called Todo Poder a Pueblo. And this organization formed in 2010, and they've been organizing autonomously since that time and demonstrating in communities after a police killing. They were organizing, and then sure enough, police, murdered somebody. I don't even know if we have time to talk about it.
Yeah, because we only have about 30 seconds, unfortunately.
Okay, so this community, since they're already established, they're not able to be co-opted by the nonprofit organizations that are established and these front groups that are established by the police. So it's so important to have autonomous community organizations that are already in place so that they can't be co-opted by the nonprofit organizations that are quick to step in collaboration with the police department and the politicians.
Well, Bradley, I just want to say, unfortunately, I'm out of time today. I really appreciate you making so much of your time available to the KDVS audience. It's been great for you to do that. And good luck in your future endeavors.
All right. Thanks a lot, Richard.
Sure.
Check out indiebay.org.
All right. That's Bradley Allen. You can check out indiebay.org, as he said, or also bradleyallen.net. This has been Speaking in Tongues. Again, this is KDVS Davis, 90.3 FM.